This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 29th of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Grundig. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Coming up today, the director of London's Design Museum, Dejan Sujic, takes us through the A to Z of design in honour of his new book.
A grizzled old sub-editor said to me, never use the word fenestration when window will do. And so I think I've always been fascinated by trying to make this stuff, which fascinates me, which I love, mean something to people who are not equally obsessed by it.
Master designer Sir Kenneth Grange introduces us to his new venture with legendary London retailer Heels.
I've never heard a bad word said about a Heels product. I think you get onto the decent vehicle while it's going.
And we stay in London to discuss the ever-changing, shape-shifting state of the city's skyline.
I think the City of London skyline is spectacular. I think it's got some great buildings. And it's probably one of the best collections of contemporary architecture you can find, I think, anywhere in the world.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Dejan Sujic has found time while being director of the Design Museum in London to pen something of a delight for those interested in design. He's in good company. His new book, B is for Bauhaus, is a dictionary come autobiography that muses its way through the alphabet, exploring the personal significance of such ideas as authenticity, functionalism, and creations like Zips. He told Section D's Aled John how and why he penned this intriguing work.
About 6 years ago, when I first started work at the Design Museum, Penguin gave me a two-book deal, the second of which was to write a dictionary of design. And of course, I got the advance and didn't hear anything about it for a year or two. And then I got a phone call from Penguin saying, well, of course, no one buys dictionaries anymore. You can keep the money, but do something else. And so it's turned into, from being a dictionary, into something which has got an A to Z format. But it's 30 or 40 musings on everything from why I wear a parka to the terrible embarrassment of my family, to the nature of fashion. I'm fascinated by YouTube, by Grand Theft Auto. So it's a look at various aspects of design through a personal perspective. I think a lot of journalists aren't very comfortable with using the word I too much, and this is quite an I book.
It is indeed. That is one point I'd like to look at if we could. Why did you take such a personal stance on it? These are your musings, as it were. Do they have to come from that kind of personal first-person narrative?
Certainly not, but I think if you go to places, meet people, some of the thoughts rub off. But I think also design is a subject which could be seen as simply talking about shape and form. And I've always thought that it's rather important to tell stories, to animate things, to show how something is made, who uses it, and why it matters.
It definitely adds a layer of, I guess, authenticity. Funny, because your first letter in the book is A for Authentic. It begins with a lovely little anecdote, as you said before, you mentioned it, the Green Parka story. Why don't you tell us, we can begin looking into the book by broaching that first, if we could.
I found myself in a Milan side street, wandering into a shop which was selling war surplus, and there on a rack was this amazing green parka, which had obviously been worn by two or three people before me, and I wanted to buy it. It wasn't because I wanted to pretend to be a mod, although I did grow up in the same London suburb as The Who. It was that was something very seductive about a garment which is not trying to be seductive. It's that sense of quality that comes from doing things for performance. So it's got this fantastic brass zip, which no fashion retailer could ever afford to use. The cuffs are held in place by webbing. There were chip buttons. There's a name tag. There's not a maker's label. It's a set of instructions. How could you not want to have such a thing?
But the idea of authenticity is something you go into as well. Just to paraphrase the book, you say it's an irresistible combination of sincerity with authority, qualities that are hard to define, but grasping them is essential to an understanding of the nature of design.
And then designers lovingly fake that sense of authenticity. If you're sitting in the Delaunay, a fantastic restaurant, you can for a moment dream that you are actually in the Vienna of 1900, talking philosophy with famous architects or looking at literature. Of course, you're not. You're talking about what was on the telly last night. It's that sense, though, of you're trying to live in a world which seems real, but which isn't necessarily real. In some ways, that's always the dichotomy of design, which has got these two poles. On the one end, it's about trying to make the world a better place. On the other hand, it's about trying to seduce us into buying stuff we don't necessarily need.
Such a big topic to get into. We don't have enough time to do so, but let's begin perhaps by looking at the range of issues that you muse upon. As you said at the top of the interview, you talk about the Xbox, Grand Theft Auto, zips, authenticity, functionality. How did you pluck these ideas for the book?
I tell you, X is for Xerox is a tough one, but luckily I discovered that Xerox and Kodak both came from the small same town in upstate New York. I think what really got me going was N is for national identity, and I think that's really the most personal. It's thinking about what got me interested in design in the first place. And I think it's partly to do with the realization that my parents came to Britain in the 1930s. My father was actually born an American citizen. My grandfather died when my father was very young. He went back to what was then Austro-Hungary, which became Yugoslavia. He became British. In his life, he could have had six different passports, which always gave me the sense that national identity is somehow rather provisional. It's manufactured. It's manufactured by how banknotes look. I remember being rather surprised when going to Yugoslavia as a kid. Banknotes had these pictures of workers and peasants and power stations. Money, I knew perfectly well, had the Queen on it and men with wigs. Passports in Yugoslavia were red with communist insignia. Here, at that time, they were blue and gold. Design is something which is used to manufacture these senses of these things. And I think that deep down is why I've always been fascinated by trying to understand how design is used to send a message, to send a signal.
It's a wonderful chapter, actually. And as you mentioned, you describe national identity as provisional but utterly compelling. Why were you compelled to it? Is it that sense of a kind of non-linear narrative of identities that you may have or that your parents may have? You yourself grew up in Acton, West London, whereas your parents, well, your dad had multifarious identities, yeah, perhaps, but they grew up for a time in Belgrade and then changed location.
People do make assumptions based on the signals which can be designed. I remember I was in Glasgow when the Scottish referendum for a Scottish Parliament came through, and I got called by the Scotsman's news desk and asked, "Mr. Sujic, as a prominent Englishman working in Scotland, have you experienced any examples of racial prejudice since you've been here?" Which is a fascinating question to be asked. I mean, Sujic is not necessarily the most English of names. I thought, what do you mean we, Tonto?
Do you think there was a danger of esotericism in this book? Who is your target audience? Is your target audience people like myself who deal and work in the sphere of design, or practitioners, journalists, or is it dinner party fodder?
I had a very lucky break when I first started writing for the Sunday Times, when a grizzled old sub-editor, a species that doesn't exist anymore, said to me, "Never use the word fenestration when window will do." And so I think I've always been fascinated by trying to make this stuff, which fascinates me, which I love, I'm obsessive about it, mean something to people who are not equally obsessed by it. I think this stuff is important. It is about these big issues. It's about how we live, what's important to us. So a little commentary whispered into people's ears is really the idea of the book.
Is this the finished product, or are there more letters, more definitions that you think you can come up with?
Oh, I think I need a break.
Dan, if we could, let's look for a moment at how, not how you put the book together, but whether or not you enjoyed it. Was this a kind of therapeutic process? Did you enjoy the process of spending some time with things that were important to you?
One of the big shifts in my career was moving from being a journalist to becoming director of the Design Museum. And that was a process that sort of taught me the sense of patience. I trained as an architect a long time ago, but realized it was not a profession for me. I didn't have the patience to do it. And since I've been at the museum, I've been gently rediscovering the art of patience. My main task has been trying to help the museum move to its new location. We're on course to go to the former Commonwealth Institute in Holland Park within 2 years. But meanwhile, in the evenings, writing books is what keeps you fresh, thinking about the subject. It gives you another life.
Dejan Sujic, author of Beers for Bauhaus and director of London's Design Museum, in conversation with Monocle's Aled John. And the book is out now. Of all the startling recent additions to London's skyline, it's perhaps the weirdest, 30 St Mary Axe, universally known as the Gherkin. But fame and a prime location have proved no guarantee of profitability. The 41-storey landmark has been placed in receivership, persistent loan defaults blamed on currency fluctuations. The Gherkin is far from the only recent addition to London's skyline. It joins the Shard, the Helter Skelter, the Cheese Grater and the Walkie Talkie. Peter Rees, Professor of Places and City Planning at University College London, and Peter Murray, Chairman of New London Architecture, joined Dominic Reynolds and Andrew Muller to discuss whether we ever needed these buildings and what should be done with them.
I don't think the building is failing to turn a profit. It's just some people have done some rather strange property deals and are losing money on currency fluctuations and all sorts of strange things. It's fully occupied, wonderful building in great condition and very popular with the people that are occupying it. This is another one of bankers.
Well, you were in charge until very recently of planning lots of what can or can't go up on London's skyline. So when people have complaints about the way it's changed, really, they can be complaining to you. Is that fair?
Some of them.
Some of them.
Only within 1 square mile of London and all for office purposes in an area that had run out of land.
OK, so give us an idea of the buildings which you would bear some responsibility for giving the green light to.
Gherkin, the Cheese Grater, which I nicknamed because I thought it looked like something Ruth Rogers might use in her kitchen at River Cafe, the Walkie Talkie. The Heron Tower, all of the tall office towers in that cluster in the eastern part of the city, well away from St Paul's Cathedral, and clustered together to minimise their environmental impact. I bear no responsibility for the cluster or for the range of demented telegraph poles that are sprouting along the south bank of the river, all the way from Bermondsey to Battersea.
I'll bring you in Peter Murray, the chairman of New London Architecture. These buildings that the other Peter there was talking about, have they been a pleasant addition to the City of London skyline, do you think?
Yes, I think the City of London skyline is spectacular. I think it's got some great buildings, and you can stand now in the middle of the city and you've got the Gherkin on one side of you, you've got the Cheese Grater the other, and Richard Rogers' original Lloyd's building opposite you. And it's probably one of the best collections of contemporary architecture you can find, I think, anywhere in the world. So that has been a great addition. I think one of the things that we realise now, though, that was just the start of a new range of tall buildings which are going to cover large swathes of London over the next few years. We did some research for our current exhibition called London's Growing Up, because London is gradually getting taller, and we found that there's some 230 odd towers which are either in planning already or have got permission, which will be constructed, which are going to happen somewhere within the central area of London.
Because London is unusual for a major financial centre, indeed arguably the major financial centre, in not being a kind of a canyon of enormous steel and glass towers. Is that something London actually needs?
Well, we need a certain number of tall buildings, and I think it's right you have a variety of buildings. Prince Charles likes the idea that we all live in anything, nothing higher than 6 floors. But I actually think tall buildings are good to live in, and Peter Rees himself lives in a tall building. And so I think we need that sort of opportunity. But we don't want them all over London. They need to be in the right place. And to a certain extent, that is a whole part of the planning system at the moment, that there are clusters like the one in the city, but also they're happening on the South Bank. They're happening over towards Battersea Power Station, a whole area which is being redeveloped. These clusters, you will see more of those over the next decade or so.
And the critics of those clusters say that once upon a time, and that critics of what's happened to the skyline under Boris Johnson particularly, say that once upon a time, in order to put something up that would change the skyline so dramatically, it needed to be of certain architectural value of itself. And people say that perhaps the Gherkin was, the Shard might be, but things like the various towers going on the South Bank simply aren't of that architectural value. They aren't original enough. Do you agree?
I don't think all tall buildings need to be terribly original. We don't want to look like Dubai in London. And I think you need also modest buildings as well as the iconic ones. I think one of the problems we have in London is that you have different developers on sites, maybe adjacent to each other, coming up with their own ideas, their own architects. They don't actually talk together enough. And actually, one of the great things that Peter did when he was at the city, he looked at the detail of how these buildings sat together, how they hit the ground, and told architects what to do. And that's very difficult to do right across 230 towers for somebody to really look at that carefully. So what we're calling on Boris Johnson to set up a skyline commission, which actually looks at how tall are buildings, not just individual buildings, but also how they group together and how they impact on the skyline, to bring some real design thinking into how you create a city at a different scale than we'd be used to in the past.
Well, is the problem, Peter Rees, the very fact that you say you looked after that particular bit of London and you said it with pride that you know, you've created a bit of skyline that works within itself. Is the problem then that you weren't talking to the other people who look after their own bits of London in itself? Does there need to be a broader conversation?
As Peter Murray has already said, there is need for strategic coordination from the mayor deciding where in London clusters should go and how tall the buildings in those clusters should be. And in between, it should be assumed that they would not be acceptable. Remember, there's a difference between what we were doing in the city, which is creating office buildings, which are maintaining or creating jobs, and the residential towers that are going up in some other parts of London, most of which are being bought by Russian money of dubious origin or gambled on by Chinese investors. Large numbers of them aren't being lived in. So we should ask ourselves the question, are these buildings really necessary to London's economy, or are they simply providing something that can be sold off plan very quickly to create a pile of safe deposit boxes?
Peter Murray of New London Architecture and Peter Rees, Professor of Places and City Planning at UCL, discussing the merits of London's skyline. After the break, we're in New York to discuss the Japanese concept of wabi.
For over six decades, Grundig has made people's lives better and simpler. To this day, we bring our expert knowledge of design and technology to a wide range of high-quality domestic appliances. Whether refrigerator or radio, oven or audio system, we continue to integrate our manufacturing heritage with state-of-the-art technology. Grundig synthesizes the best of yesterday with the best of tomorrow, expertly and innovatively designed for you and your home. Grundig, supreme engineering, timeless design.
You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, here on Monocle 24. The Japanese concept of wabi is derived from simplicity, favouring natural materials for their timelessness and imperfection. This is the drive behind the work of Belgian designer Axel Vervoort, and it is ever apparent in the just-completed penthouse he designed sitting atop the Greenwich Hotel in New York. Just following the completion of the duplex suite, Axel took Megan Billings from our New York bureau on an early morning tour of the quiet space in Tribeca.
Together with Tatsuro Mikio sitting next to me, we made this concept of wabi, with the book The Spirit of Wabi, where we worked a lot on to find this universal key between East and West, old and new, and try to find a new language in a way where all these things meet, and with the concept which we called Art Tempo, art made by time. Like you see this table, it's totally aged and it's like without interruption. It's the time itself is also artists who made this work. It's almost like abstract art. And so trying to find with very humble things something very noble and very serene and very quiet. And for us it was like creating a space in the middle of busy New York, you know, where you really can come to yourself and discover a beautiful, serene quietness. But still it's quite intelligent. It's not rustic. It, for some people, it might look like a first appeal. It's rustic, but it's quite intellectual in a way. You know, also from the beginning, the old architecture is based on the cube and all the sacred architecture of golden section, double cube and all that. Even the beams, they have a deeper sense. It comes from the Japanese philosophy of tokonobashi, and they represent wisdom, and they're here like four pillows that surround you to make this all different. The walls are painted with the earth of New York, all the stones is found here in New York, so a lot of things what we made like treasures from what others do throw away. because we think the 21st century is a century. We have to use what's been used already. There's no rocks enough, there's no forests enough to continue making new, and there's also no place anymore to throw it all away. And that concept is very important, I think, to learn to live with beautiful things, but also the beauty of the imperfection.
This is my introduction to Wabi, actually.
Yes.
And you're right, it's so quiet here and very peaceful. And this space is decorated with all of these things that you've found. And I want to know about that. Mm-hmm. Are they things that you stumble upon? Do you know exactly where something is going to go when you find it? How do you find these objects? And just tell me about that.
Because the word decorated is already, for me, it's good you tell it, because I think most people will use this. But it's for us, it's more like creating an installation. It's more like an artistic installation. And because it's for a hotel, it's not for somebody. So it is for somebody who will want to live Wabi for a while, you know, 3 days, because you can only get it minimum 3 days or for a month. So we could go very profound in all these concepts, and finding things is like looking for treasures and discovering, and they inspire you, and then you say, this is what we need. And it's never like a prejudged concept. I think it's a growing process. That's why it also takes time, because if you do one thing, then the other follows and continues like that. And but it's absolutely a fascinating voyage, or do you say, you know, a pilgrimage, you know, to achieve it all.
That's a good point. It takes time. So when you're designing a beautiful penthouse like this with multiple bedrooms and sitting rooms, bathrooms, a dining room, how long does it take, that process?
Well, it depends where it is. New York was not easy, being above a hotel, so we could only work after 11 o'clock in the morning, had to stop before 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Cranes could only come on a Sunday when Sunday was not too windy. So there's been lots of difficult things which made it take longer. When we made the first project, we already, I think, visualized it, and we stayed quite close to that first project, but in the details you continue and go further. And I think our painter, who came from Belgium, also did a great job. Oh, we also, all the plaster work is all very, very organic plaster. It's not it's very chalk plaster, so which absorbs all the colors very well, and this also gives this depth and silence. And yes, but it's been a wonderful experience, and I must say Robert De Niro was very supporting, and he loved it. And because he came to us in Belgium and visited the castle and the canal and in all our books, and he put postage everywhere. And then we realized his real taste is this Wabi taste, and that's how it did grow. And then he said, Axel, why don't you try? Because I'm trying for many years to get permission to build a penthouse on top of the hotel, and Landmark Commission never agreed, but you might do another project. And then I called Tatsuro Miki, he's architect, you know, and we worked on other projects as well, and let's try. And then Taro was very interesting, like a Japanese. I still remember for this big official sitting in the Landmark Commission, all the 12 engineers were there, public seating, press. So we had to go and explain what was Wabi. So I thought, that, and then when you see those big marble columns and bronze elevator, I think that nobody will ever understand this. And they really were very enthusiastic. And the lawyer said, if you have 3 positive votes by the 12th, we can go and second appeal, and then it might take long. But then it was, the wonder was that we had 12 positive votes by 12 from the first sitting. So Landmark Commission immediately loved it, and even some members asked, can we see some more of the Wabi also outside? Which was a great compliment, and it was really a very positive moment. And Robert Denis and Ira, they were so pleased after that.
I know that there are pieces here. There are some from Japan. There are some from your own home in Belgium. There are some local pieces from the farmers market even. Can you take maybe 2 or 3 things that are your favorites and describe them to me?
Yes, I think a lot of some planches, like it started with this table, which we had at the New York at the Armory Fair, you know, the International Antique Dealer, and really Bob fell in love with the table. That was the first thing he bought, and I still think it's a great table. It's a chestnut table, made from wood from the 16th century, most probably has been outside in the mountains for a few hundred years, and that gate is a wonderful patina that only the time can make. And then we've been looking for stones, and we found a stone, and then at the end, because at the beginning we did not want to put art. So the art was made by time. There's only objects that the time transformed, and that we looked at it like art. Like even concrete walls we left there with old inscriptions, but everything happened here. It's never been done to be beautiful, but it make me remember to a Cy Twombly painting. Then I think there's some furniture we made from old, which I really love. And then after the ending, then we had a friend, a potter, who made very beautiful ceramics to use here that really fits in the spirit. Not too Japanese, not too old, not too modern, you know, but something that's just right and harmonious. And then even almost at the last minute, like for that wall, we wanted to keep it empty, but just empty was not enough. So then we say we want to a piece of art that really fills this emptiness, that creates a full emptiness. And then we thought on Otto Boll, you know, it's a German artist who made this very delicate circle there. And I think now this wall is very finished, and I think it's one of my favorite arts. And another friend potter in Japan, Tsuchimura, he decided, I said, I want also to belong to this penthouse, and you can choose pieces from me, or I make pieces from me. So he made that big vase there, based on a concept of New York. You know, so he made it like a square, big building, but in pottery and earth, and baked it. And so he gave a few other things. And then another artist friend, Dominique Strauband, he gave us some projects of big sculptures he made in terracotta. They also look very humble and silent. So I think it can still evolve a little. It's not like finished now, you know. I think all good things are never finished, especially here. All the concept of the furniture, it's almost like unfinished furniture. Huh? Yes.
Axel Vervoort with our Megan Billings there. After a fateful lottery entry for a US green card, Aussie-born illustrator Craig Redman relocated to New York 7 years ago. He and his London-based design partner form a distant duo called Craig and Carl, and they've created work for projects with LVMH, Google, Nike, Vogue, and the New York Times. The designer brought Monocle Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi to his studio to chat about the duo's colourful, geometric portraits and some of their recent projects. I gotta testify, come up in the spot looking extra fly. For the day I
die, I'ma touch the sky. I think one of the very early pieces of Craig and Carl was the portrait I did of Kanye. That was probably the very first thing that got a lot of attention, and because of that we've done lots and lots of other portraits. Like we did a portrait of Obama for the cover of New York Magazine for when he won his second term.
So help me God. Congratulations, Mr. President.
We also did portraits for Turkish Airlines, for Manchester United. We did five huge portraits that were on the stadium. We've done Charles and Ray for Herman Miller, a new tapestry that's going to be released in their stores soon. But outside the portraits, I think another project that was really good for us was 72DP, which is the name of the project of this car park we did in Australia. It was a private residence, and we were commissioned by the owner to... It was a really bland, you know, car park, so to jazz up his car park. Super colourful, very immersive experience, floor, ceiling, all four walls. And I think because of that project as well, it kind of kickstarted Craig and Carl early on.
I'm looking at some of your designs here hanging on your studio's walls. And despite them being very geometrical and full of shapes and colours, and sometimes it seems they wouldn't work, but somehow they balance out. How do you achieve that balance and that equilibrium?
Yeah, I think there is, we're talking about the portraits, and I think there is a kind of a grossness to them. Like there's quite lurid colors, and you know, realistically those kind of patterns shouldn't work together. And I think maybe that's something that we are quite good at, is putting this weird mixture of patterns and colors together. And originally it starts as a trial and error thing. Does that green work next to this blue? No, it doesn't. Maybe we'll try a different color. And you kind of get knowledge over the years and you know what kind of works. I think it comes down to us just pushing shapes around and having a certain eye for what works and what doesn't.
Let's have a look around the rest of your studio here and maybe show me a few of the other examples. I love the VIP Danish trash can. What's designed on it?
So a lot of the stuff you see around the studio is products that I've done with my blog, Darcel Disappoints. Darcel was a blog, it's an illustrated blog that I created when I first moved to New York, so about 7 years ago. It was kind of my take on just observations I'd had about the city when I first moved here, being a very naive Australian. And early on in the life of the blog, maybe within the first 6 months, Sarah from Colette, the store in Paris, picked up on it and asked me to do some collaborative projects with her. And ever since then, for 6 years, we've been working on different things together. So around the studio, you can see like a candle, a Darcel candle I did. There's like mugs, lighters, candies, telephone cases. There's also some sunglasses over there. Carl and I just finished with a brand called Le Specs. When they asked us last year to do a collection with them, we were super excited because I think their sensibilities and our sensibilities are quite similar. They have kind of a good sense of humor. So that was a fun project to work on. It's still out at the moment, actually.
How do you manage to innovate while staying true to your design and your style?
I think the most important thing within this kind of industry is that you have to create constantly. You have to be able to create new work all the time. And you have to be able to move with trends as well. If you get stuck in a particular rut or if you get known too well for a particular thing, when that trend dies, then your business kind of dies with it. So you really have to force yourself to be innovative all the time. And that can come from, you know, just an idea you had sitting in your living room, or it could come from seeing an incredible show in Chelsea, or it could just be something ridiculous that you see in the street. I think for both Carl and I, we kind of take in everything around us, which is very cliched, but we kind of Frankenstein it together into our own ideas. Kind of a postmodern approach, I guess.
That was Craig Redman, a design duo Craig and Carl, speaking to Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi. But first, for our latest May issue, Toronto Bureau Chief Nelly Gotcheva went to Peterborough, a small town about 2 hours' drive from Toronto, to visit Trent University. One of Canada's most striking architectural estates, the campus was built in the 1960s by the late Ron Tom. Before he was engaged in this project, the British Columbia-born architect had masterminded a large handful of landmarks across Canada, including the University of Toronto's Massey College and the Electra Building in Vancouver. While working on the story, Nelly met Tom's son Adam, an architect in his own right. Today, he co-heads, with his wife Katia Arga-Saxa, Practice Arga-Tom. They talked about British Columbian influences in Trent's blueprints, today's Canadian architecture, and Ron Tom's legacy.
I think he's certainly known for his sensitivity, and anyone would say the way he approached the field of architecture was an artistic bent to his work, but his handling of material and his synthesis of craft, material, and design certainly stemmed from not only appreciation of art making, but an experience in art making, a direct experience.
And also, apparently, his buildings and his architecture is so involved with the surroundings of the area where the building would be, whether it's a house or Trent University, for example. So do you think that this was like something specific for him, or do you think that this was something that all the architects at that point would actually take in consideration?
I think in my opinion, the architects of the West Coast were a little bit more attuned to the importance of site and starting with site and relating everything they did to the context. But he was particularly focused on that and skilled at that. One of his top skills was becoming intimate with the site before he started to design the building. He would go to if there was a hillside project, he would spend a day there sketching and sitting and looking and touching trees and walking it. And I don't think a lot of architects do that these days, and not many in his day either.
Do you think that this was something like kind of his idea and his connection with the nature come somehow from British Columbia, and he basically transported this took this with him when moving to Toronto.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he would talk constantly about that, and it was a very real part of his role. But he also had a huge romance for the wilderness and the landscapes of British Columbia and everywhere, and in Ontario too, but he certainly brought a passion of the land, the light, the trees and so forth with him from BC and brought it directly to Ontario.
Do you think that then, given where Trent is and it's right at the outskirts of Peterborough and you have this amazing landscapes there, so do you think that he felt more kind of, let's say, at ease creating there compared to, for example, Massey University because it's in the middle of the city?
That's fair to say that he would be more at ease in the natural landscape. But I think coming from British Columbia to that part of Ontario, which is gorgeous in its own way, was actually a really positive way to challenge his understanding of site and context.
What are the influences today for, you know, like Canadian design, Canadian architecture? Do you think that you have like your own kind of domestic, like, you know, like homemade Canadian style? Or do you think that the architects still get inspired by different countries and parts of the world?
No, I think there's, despite the accessibility of international images, mm-hmm. there's still a lineage going on here. And there's firms out there that, it's easier to talk about other firms in this regard, but there's firms that you could make a collected set of dots that connect current contemporary firms with the kind of work that was going on here with Dad's work. For instance, Shim Sutcliffe is a perfect example, and the Packhausen in BC, I mean, they're very much influenced from Canadian architecture directly, both from their studying it and being around it, but also actually working in these offices. This is only one generation we're talking about. And that's the way it should be. I mean, we should all continue to explore regional flair, and because we, you know, just the climate alone, but the culture of needs to be built on, and that'll come out in time, but I think there's definitely a direct connection. And I would say that I'm definitely, like, we're all, anybody that works here, that grew up here, we're all kind of grew up walking these streets and talking about what we see and how we live in these cities. And it's very important, I think.
That was our Toronto Bureau Chief, Nelly Gotcheva, talking to Adam Tom. Coming after the break, we talk to Mark Newson.
Grundig's goal is to bring the best of the world's entertainment into your home. Its digital and DAB Plus radios allow you to access an unlimited choice of broadcasters from around the world and to listen to them with the most superior sound quality. Its new Bluetooth-enabled audio products let you play music from your smartphone. Grundig is committed to making sound crystal clear, whether it's beaming in from the other side of the world or from a mobile right next to you. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Leading eyewear maker Safilo is celebrating its 80th anniversary this year, having matured from humble beginnings in the small town of Cadore to becoming the world's second largest producer of frames and lenses. The occasion is being marked by a special collaboration with Australian designer Mark Newson, who's created works in fields as varied as bicycles and commercial aircraft, to furniture and architectural commissions. Revisiting a historical Safilo model in 5 variations, the collection characterises the different innovations of Safilo's history with a modern twist. The capsule collection was unveiled during Salone del Mobile in Milan, highlighting the strong relationship between design and fashion that were integral in the conception of the project. Mark gave Monocle's Alexa Firmanich a sneak preview of the models in London's Dover Street Market.
You know, I wanted to be able to wear these things. I wanted them to be functional. I wanted them to work on a practical level. I wanted them to look good. I wanted them to have a certain feel. I wanted them to be slightly different to what exists on the market right now. And, you know, necessarily, it means you're going to kind of look back, you know, somehow. Doesn't mean that I was, you know, appropriating an old design, because it's quite different to any of the other pieces. But it was a little bit like when I designed a car, you know, I took an image of a car that everybody's familiar with, and then you work with the details, you know, you work with the material, you work with the process, you work with all of the things that, all of the other variables that you can play with. And the shape, in a sense, becomes just a kind of a placeholder.
So now that we're in front of the glasses, could you talk through the five different models and which one sort of represents different innovations throughout the time?
The main premise for the project that we've done, the collaboration that we've done together, you know, rather than designing five different styles, I opted to design one style and extrapolate that out in five or six different materials and different processes and different techniques, because that's kind of the way that I work. You know, once I've established a kind of design language or a style that I like, I tend to focus on that one thing, you know, rather than choosing five different ones. You know, I'm much more interested in playing with materials and playing with techniques, looking through all of the expertise that Safilo has, for example. And these really, you know, sort of exemplify all of the particular areas of expertise that Safilo have, the things that they're really good at doing in-house. For example, the UFO, which is a technique that was invented by Safilo in the late 60s, I believe. You know, this looks pretty normal now to most people, but this was actually invented by them, you know, and it was called UFO.
Because of the bending.
It's a kind of like a high tensile, well, it's a spring steel basically, but it's the way that it's attached to the frame and it sits in there. When it was done, it was completely innovative. So we've sort of reintroduced this. I like these are one of my favorites. They're in the machined aluminium, so you don't often see frames which are actually made from a solid piece of aluminium and machined. Then aluminium is a material which I've used extensively. I like it a lot because it's lightweight, it's strong, it's high-tech, it feels very modern, and it feels very qualitative. As I say, it's machined from a solid lump, so it's sort of quite a luxurious technology. The typical Safilo material is a type of plastic, a type of synthetic material called Optil. So this is the kind of, you know, what I would call a sort of generic frame. It's really simple, black, very refined, and very, very, very simple, very clean. Strong, robust, you know, I could sort of wear these every day.
That was Mark Newson revealing his latest sunglass collection to Alexa Firminich. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Located on London's historical furniture hub of Tottenham Court Road, home furnishing store Heels has been in business for almost 200 years. Although it remains one of the UK's leading design retailers, its heyday was undoubtedly during the turn of last century, when Sir Ambrose Heal brought the arts and crafts movement to the masses. He was interested in good design at reasonable prices. Ambrose is also rather appropriately the name of a new homeware and furniture collection that Heals has just launched. Aimed at young professionals, a wide breadth of British talent has been involved in designing the range, which has been headed up by RCA graduate David Steiner and design director Sir Kenneth Grange. I caught up with a pair ahead of the launch this week to discuss what we can expect from the collection, how it stays true to Sir Ambrose's motto, nothing need not be ugly, and the effect of the internet on design retail today. David started off by introducing me to the Ambrose approach.
Ambrose Heal was the great-grandson of our founder, and he was running the business for about 60 years from the late 19th century. He was very much interested in the arts and crafts movement, but he saw the reality of the fact that not everyone could afford to have handmade furniture that was made in the Cotswolds. And so he was very much interested in bringing well-made and lasting furniture to a mass market. What we're taking from Ambrose is a focus on people who've got smaller spaces, space issues.
And when you mentioned that it's for people with sort of smaller spaces to fill, I mean, are we talking about sort of a younger market?
The customer will be a little bit younger than Heels, but we're aware of the fact that a sort of space solution might not just be saving space, it might be actually getting something into a space, which is such a common problem in London. So it's not like we're trying to make matchbox furniture, it's just more intelligently done.
Do you think that a younger market is now actually interested in and invested in the way things are made, how things are made, and good quality?
I certainly hope so, and I believe the signs are there, and it's been greatly affected by the downturn in the economy and the emergence of arguments about buying things you expect to last. This is almost a new sort of branch of journalism, virtually, making that a meritorious discussion.
And how does that play out in the way things look and the way things are actually designed?
I think it certainly can play out in terms of them being less predictable. For example, Kea has popularized an absolutely intelligent and very, very economically elegant way of making cupboards. But the consequence is particular details that if you change, you're going to pay more for it. So it's become like the standard expectation of a box. Change those details and you change the value of the product quite significantly.
How would you describe the personality of the collection as a whole, in your opinion?
It's not rectilinear. If you think through that, the manufacturing of cabinet work, of almost a great deal of the stuff we inhabit our homes, of necessity by the manufacturing process, is rectilinear, and therefore it's become the commonplace. Not the worst, and no great downsides. You can buy very expensive rectilinear things, but it is the normal. Whereas when you want to open people's mind to a new product and open their mind to its origins and its history and this, that and the other, I think you're beholden to give it enough distinction to be memorable as they walk round and compare it with other things. So it's distinctiveness you're looking for.
And David, Ambrose Knit Heels maxim was nothing need not be ugly. How did that resonate when you were going about doing this collection?
Well, I mean, the way you feel about the look of things is always going to be very subjective, but we're very much careful to curate things to be how we perceive them to be, fitting our brief. There's a thing about multifunctional furniture that automatically conjures up some very clumsy gate leg table type things. And we really wanted to get away from that and say that, yes, it's intelligent, but that doesn't have to be subservient to being beautiful as well. So obviously, we always want to marry the function and the beauty, but yeah, very keen not to let the function just override everything, I suppose.
How prominent are the designers that you're working with?
We're really keen to promote the designers because they're the guys who make things happen, and we think there's no reason to be shy of talking about who we're working with because we're really proud of that.
We're quite determined that not only will the product be branded, which often isn't the case with furniture, but the branding will include the designer's name. So that will appear on every single piece that's made. And that's really peculiar in this country. Not so odd in Italy, but it's never really taken root here. So that of itself is a celebration, I think, of the partnership with the younger designers.
Yeah.
Can't see any downside at all to it, but only that, you know, only the upside.
What attracted you to be involved in this project?
It's quite a lot to do with Heels. It's a fabulous brand. I grew up with it, certainly all my generation did. It's an institution, and so you feel some obligation to institutions. You have to keep them going, do your damnedest to see that they keep going, but in a constructive way. And I think it's, coming together very well. I think it's also got an interesting relationship to this part of London. Tottenham Court Road has been sliding downhill for a long time, and I expect that Heels has been caught in that slide, quite apart from its philosophy and its product choicing. The street's due for a big, big upgrade. So to that extent, I think we're right at the onset, as a thin end of a very big and wonderful wedge, I think.
So many brands are so concerned with sort of reissuing old classics and relying on the old design classics to sort of keep them going at the moment. Why is it so, whether unique or just very important, that Heels is doing this to invest in young British design?
Somebody should do it. That's a really good enough reason in itself. It's not much of a well-worked area, oddly enough. What I think is also very encouraging is that it's really constructively responsive to the changes that's gone on in the world. You know, people don't have so much money to just waste and so on, so they're bound to be more thoughtful about getting value for what they do spend. And in a way, that is Heels' own old philosophy. And so in a strange way, what Ambrose was looking to do all those years ago has really found its market, because the market in those days was altruistic and not an easy one to answer. So the Heels product was perhaps mostly still bought by fairly well-heeled people. But today, the marketplace has changed, and both are young and old too. So I really do think that it's perfect time for a firm. And Heels is a very peculiar example, I think. Its goodwill is huge. The goodwill out there among people who probably never bought anything in Heels, but soon through family associations, etc., etc., I've never heard a bad word said about a Heels product. So it's you get onto the decent vehicle while it's going.
That was David Steiner and Sir Kenneth Grange introducing Heels' new Ambrose retail venture to me there. Head to ambrose.co.uk to see the collection for yourself. And that brings us to the end of today's show. It's been produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer Aled at awj@monocle.com if you want to feature on the show or if you have any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris. And to play you out, after our stories on the tall buildings of London and some nice new sunglasses, here's The Big Sky by Kate Bush. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.